Okay, let's get going. Slight switch in the program because of time limitations for some of our speakers. I'm gonna skip to the... Thank you. You didn't want to hear me. Thanks, board member Smith.
It was fine, I didn't need to like...
So, as you know, we talked a little bit about the DNR's 20-year forest health plan at the November board meeting. And I've asked Chuck Hershey from our wildfire program to come and give us a quick overview of that program. So, Chuck, could you introduce yourself and take it away?
Sure, my name's, my name's Chuck Hershey. I'm the Forest Health Program Manager within the Wildfire Division at DNR. And I was the staff lead responsible for putting together this 20-year forest health strategic plan. So thanks, Stephen, for inviting me to give a little update to the board on this important effort. We received the following sentence in a budget proviso from the legislature, asking us to develop a 20-year strategic plan to treat areas of state forest land that have been identified by the department as being in poor health. You can interpret that a lot of different ways. You could say, well, we're just going to focus on state trust lands. But given where we're at with forest health, this 20-year strategic plan is not the starting place of our investments in forest health. We've been, as an agency, focused on forest health for the last 15 years or so and sort of building up to this moment. And based on that, we sort of realized that we couldn't just focus on state or private lands like we had in the past. We really need to take an all lands approach. And so, if you can see, there's a copy of the plan on the desk out there for folks. If people want more copies, let me know. We have sort of a summary as well as the full plan. So just to quickly go through some of the quick highlights. It was released in October in Cleveland. We started drafting it in about January of 2017. Worked with a lot of different stakeholders and agencies, and both federal, tribal, environmental, industry, et cetera, the whole gamut of folks that are interested in forest health in the state of Washington. And so, at a very high level, the plan tasks us with treating 1.25 million acres by 2037, roughly 60,000 acres per year. Set some high-level vision, guiding principles, process moving forward, as well as goals and strategies to move forest health forward. As I mentioned, it gives us sort of an all-lands approach. Can't just focus on state trust lands. We only own about 10% of land in eastern Washington, and so even if our land was in perfect tip-top shape, given the scales of forest health issues and wildfire issues, it wouldn't necessarily be enough. This plan is based in science, which I think you'll see, and like I said, a real important component is that social license component. We have a variety of organizations involved. So what are we trying to achieve with this forest health strategic plan? If you can read the vision statement, it says Washington's forested landscapes are in an ecologically functioning and resilient condition and meet the economic and social needs of present and future generations. So, a pretty balanced statement, which I think one would expect from the state of Washington, given all the varied interests that we represent. We're looking to invest in landscapes where we can achieve that balance, where we can have ecologically resilient systems, as well as, meet our economic and social needs. So how are we gonna get there? What's our mission? The vision statement only took about an hour and a half to craft in a room of 30 to 40 folks, which actually wasn't too bad, even though it sounds painful. Wordsmithing can be quite painful. The mission statement, that took many weeks and different meetings and going back and forth to really nail this one down. And the mission statement says, We will restore and manage forested landscapes at a pace and scale that reduces the risk of uncharacteristic wildfire and increases the health and resilience of forests and aquatic ecosystems in a changing climate for rural communities and the people of Washington State. So there's quite a bit to unpack in there, but we're sort of focused on forested landscapes, not just forests, but realizing all the values that are tied to forests, our wildlife, our water, recreation, etc. And we want to reduce the risk of uncharacteristic wildfire. We recognize wildfires are a natural part of eastern Washington and will continue to be, but there's a lot of sort of unnatural fires that are occurring due to the increased fuel loads that have accumulated over the last several decades. And we also want to sort of focus on rural communities as well as all people in the state. So how are we going to do this? Well, our overarching strategy is to sort of work at the watershed scale and really implement treatments at that scale. And that's going to require all the various major landowners in the watershed working together over a relatively short period of time to implement enough treatments that you're flipping the risk profile of the forest. Currently, you know, if you look at the top, currently our treatments for various landowners tend to be scattered. Sometimes they're near each other, sometimes they're not. Dr. Paul Hesberg with the U.S. Forest Service is a wildfire scientist, and you know, he often says in order to flip that risk profile in a given watershed, you typically need to treat 30 or 40% in a given time. And certainly I think for the most part we're treating maybe 10 or 15% of a watershed when we go in there or less. And so that's what the sort of overarching strategy is here, that we need to focus our efforts in these priority watersheds and then do enough treatment over, say, 2 to 3 biennium that you really change the risk profile, because these forests are so big in terms of the unhealthy conditions, the overstock conditions, that when these fires get rolling, there's not a lot we can do about that. And so you need to get in before the fires, change those vegetation conditions so the dynamics of fire and how it plays out, the effect of fire changes. You know, we're not necessarily looking to, I don't think we're assuming we can reduce the amount of fire on the landscape, especially anywhere in the next couple decades. But I think we can reduce the negative impacts of uncharacteristic wildfire. And so there's several high-level goals, 5 goals. The first goal talks about conducting 1.25 million acres of our scientifically sound landscape scale cross-boundary treatments.
Excuse me, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Sorry, I did interrupt your flow here, but it gets back to this 1.25.
Yep.
What's, by percentage, what amount of our forested landscape would you say is in poor health?
So there's a couple ways of looking at that. One is the Nature Conservancy did a study which looked at current vegetation conditions, so how much late zero closed, late zero open forest we have compared to what was historically, and the delta of that is the restoration need. And they estimated about 2.7 million acres in eastern Washington.
So this is less than half of it.
Yeah. And the reason it's less is because that 2.7 doesn't account for accessibility and can you really go in and manage.
Well, you're going to target something
yeah.
rather than the whole state. That,
yeah.
That is helpful.
Yeah. And there's also a National Insect Disease Risk Map of the Forest Service that estimates areas with increased levels of mortality from insects and disease. And that number also comes up, surprisingly, to about 2.7 million acres. So a couple million acres is the need.
Thank you.
Yep. And so for goal two, you know, we want to reduce the risk of uncharacteristic wildfire to protect a variety of assets, obviously, and we have strategies around that. An important piece as well is that economic piece. We need to add value to these small trees that we're harvesting. For those that currently don't have a market or are too far away from the market, so really recognizing the importance of having a healthy forest product sector that can add value to the material coming off so that we can fund these treatments as well as spur rural economic development as well for its own sake. And goal four talks about we need to plan and implement these landscape scale treatments, coordinate with all the various partners primarily the Forest Service being a major one because they're the major landowner, but also respect each other's different objectives and responsibilities. And goal five is the thing I think everybody understands the importance of, but we don't often fund very well, is the monitoring component. You know, what are our measures of success? How do we track that progress over time and adapt as needed? So if you look in the plan, like I said, there's some strategies under each of these goals. I'm going to focus a little bit on goal one and some of the strategies under there. So how do we go about conducting 1.25 million acres? Well, there's forest health treatment needs across eastern Washington. So in order to make a difference and work at a watershed scale, we're going to need to prioritize where we go. We can't go everywhere at once. And so we did a prioritization process that we then went and met with local stakeholders, agencies to sort of calibrate and refine based off of their feedback to select planning areas. And I'll talk about that more. We need to work at sort of a landscape scale, have the coordination. We also need to work with our forest collaboratives. Those are sort of groups of different stakeholders, agencies, the flavor of which is a little different in each area. There's a couple in western Washington, there's several in eastern Washington, but that's sort of where you get the social license to really move these projects forward. And so that's sort of my high-level overview of the plan. Now, where we are currently is we are currently in the process of implementing the plan. There was a piece of legislation passed the past session, Senate Bill 5546, which tasked DNR to analyze 200,000 acres of fire-prone lands every biennium. And from that analysis, assess what the forest health treatment needs are, prioritize the list of those forest health treatment needs, and submit a request to the legislature. Now, what's interesting about Senate Bill 5546 is that this is an all lands bill. It requires us to look at all lands, not just state trust lands or private lands. And so we have hired the state's first forest health restoration scientist, Dr. Derek Churchill, to lead the analysis around those efforts. And so this is a brief sort of description of the major steps that we need to do. We need to first select the planning areas, and that's currently where we are right now, step one. We then need to conduct a landscape evaluation and look at what is the condition of the forest, what's the risk profile, and from that, develop landscape prescriptions that can reduce fire risk, reduce forest health, insect and disease risk, and use that to form the basis of our appropriations request. And so normally we have about 18 months to do this all. We have about 10 months or so, given the fact of when the legislation was passed and getting everyone up to speed. So there's a lot of work to accomplish here in the next couple of months. But so as I mentioned, we're sort of at step one, selecting the planning areas. In this document, in the 20-year plan, there's a description in the appendix of the prioritization process that we undertook at a HUC 5 level. So a HUC 5 watershed is about 150,000 acres. We have since broken that down into a HUC 6 level prioritization, which follows the same basic methodology as the HUC 5 prioritization that's in this document. We have a few new data sets, but the basic methodology is the same. And so we wanted to prioritize watersheds for many different reasons, one of which, like I mentioned, we only have so many resources and we need to figure out which watersheds we're going to focus in. And we also wanted to understand, given all the things that the broad state of Washington cares about, what are our priorities from the state of Washington perspective, so that we can always have that lens when we're looking at particular watersheds. And so the way we have constructed our prioritization is sort of two tiers. Tier one is our forest health, wildfire risk, and we looked at fire probability, insect and disease risk, restoration need, sort of that departure assessment, and climate change to give us a score for each HUC 6 watershed of forest health, wildfire risk. We then looked at tier two, what are our values at risk? What are the resources that we care about? So we had a score for aquatic system health, wildland urban interface, drinking water, timber volume, and wildlife and added those all together. And so this is a bit of a close-up of Tier 1. I'll show you some maps comprising these data sets. On the left is fire probability. So the darker reddish colors are our highest fire probabilities that range from sort of zero up to probability of any acre burning up to 4.7% in a given year. On the right is the projected increase in fire probability over time due to climate change. And let's see here, then we go, we also considered fire intensity. So what's the probability of a fire? And if a fire occurs, what's its potential impact to the resources? So we combine those two and sort of have a score for our fire risk. We also included climate change projections in terms of increase in water balance deficit, so increase in drought stress over time. That's the image on the left. And then the National Forest Insect and Disease Risk Map. So that areas in red on the right represent estimated tree basal area loss of 20% or more over the next 15 years. And then we also included sort of our departure and restoration. So this is the, on the left is the percent active restoration need of forest land within those watersheds, and on the right is sort of the acres of active restoration need. So we took all those various layers, added them up equally, and got a score for the various HUC-6 watersheds at a Tier 1 level. Then we looked at sort of Tier 2, our values at risk, and we used three different data sets to form one measure of aquatic system health. We had a woolly layer, the drinking water. We had an accessible timber data set. Basically, it was 12,000 board feet per acre within 1,500 feet of a road, and also had a value in there on the slope, less than 35%, as well as some wildlife data sets. So apologize if the colors are a little wonky on the screen, but on the left is listed fish stream miles, so the number of fish stream miles with listed fish in it. On the right is a national data set, the Habitat Condition Index, and that's for aquatic habitat condition. On the left is projected maximum stream temperature in 2040, with the blue streams being less than 16 degrees Celsius and the red greater than that. Let's see. On the left here is the forested wildland urban interface. That's basically, there's a data set called Where People Live, which is an estimate of housing density. We buffered that by a half mile and intersected it with forest land. And it's a pretty good approximation of, especially for this type of exercise, where we're just doing relative values between watersheds. On the right is the forest of faucets. That's where there's important drinking water, according to the Forest Service. On the left is the potential conversion treatment acres. So that's those areas with 12,000 board feet per acre or more within 1,500 feet of a road. So you see sort of in Clickitat County and up in Northeast Washington is where the most timber is. And then areas with less than 35% slopes. And then we got a couple different wildlife data sets. So we added those all up together equally and created this Tier 2 map. And so what we did then is we added the Tier 1, the forest health wildfire risk, and added the values at risk, again, equally together, to create what we're calling our forest health priority HUC-6 watersheds. And so you can see there's priority watersheds located throughout eastern Washington. And so that's sort of the basis of our sort of prioritization moving forward. Now, I'm assuming as data changes and conditions in the forest change, we'll be updating this because our forests are dynamic and our understanding of them certainly is. But I think this is a pretty good scientific basis for understanding where we should invest our resources. And this just compares our HUC-5 and our HUC-6 level prioritization, and you know they're telling similar stories. There's some nuances in there that you get at the HUC-6 level that you don't at the HUC-5. Okay, So where we are right now in the process is we took that prioritization and went and met with the Forest Service as well as all of the forest collaboratives in eastern Washington and sort of said, hey, this is our cut of where the priorities are, where your understanding locally where the priorities are, and sort of melded that and put together some maps of some proposed planning areas for the 2018 and the 2020 cycle. And so I wanted to help us think a little bit about, so in these planning areas, we're going to need to go in and analyze all lands and build an appropriations request based off of that analysis for either the planning or implementation of forest health treatments. And so obviously, a big landowner is going to be the Forest Service. And so there's a couple different types of planning areas depending on their stage of NEPA planning and what our involvement will be and what we might request funding for. And so in those areas that are brand new planning areas where the Forest Service hasn't really done any NEPA, DNR will conduct what we call an all lands landscape evaluation, which can sort of serve as the veg analysis to feed right into a pre-NEPA process. And so in those instances, we would request funding for the state and private lands in those landscapes that we identify the treatment needs. And we could potentially request funding for NEPA planning, assuming that there's capacity out there for that work to be completed. Then there's other sorts of landscapes that are sort of already, the Forest Service is already doing NEPA. We would again conduct, we would sort of evaluate the non-US Forest Service lands to figure out what the treatment need is on the state and private lands. We'd request funding for those. And we also would evaluate the federal lands to make sure we're achieving our risk reduction goals. Typically when we're going out at the Forest Service, when the planning is occurring, they're often winnowing down, narrowing down the scope of treatments. And I think we need to, instead of why, be like, why not? Because in order to meet that target of treating 30 or 40% of a watershed, we're really gonna have to increase the amount of treatments we're doing. And then there's some watersheds where we'll analyze where the NEPA's already completed. And again, we'll evaluate the non-Forest Service lands, ask for funding for those treatments, and also make sure, hey, did the Forest Service identify an adequate level of treatment in their NEPA process? And so this is a draft map of proposed planning areas. And again, it's a bit hard to see here. The red areas are areas we're proposing for the 2018 cycle. And so when I say the 2018 cycle, it means DNR would conduct our analysis in 2018, and in the fall, late summer, early fall, put together our appropriations request based on that analysis for funding in the 19 to 21 biennium. And so we also have outlined some 2020 areas as well. And so you can see there's quite a decent geographic distribution there. We're in the process of refining the boundaries of these watersheds based on feedback from a variety of agencies and stakeholders. And this map shows our proposed planning areas over our prioritization. And so you can see, for the most part, we're hitting our high priority areas. I think the average priority score of all those HUC-6 watersheds that we analyze as planning areas or propose as planning areas is around 7, so right in the high range. So that's all I have, so I'll leave it there. Questions?
Questions from board members, board member Davis?
Yes.
Yeah, this is awesome. I'm wondering, maybe going and taking it down a step further, when you define the planning areas, is there a process that we'll all plug into in being from Fish and Wildlife? I'm thinking spotted owls, lynx, other things east of the mountains that we're all trying to work to recover on the landscape. Where would we plug in as we start to plan out what landscape treatments were after And when I say that, I have like, we have an occupied spot at Alsite. Do we build fire breaks around that to keep it? And do we plan the treatments to kickstart some replacement habitat through time?
Yep.
Things like that. So I'm just wondering where my folks would plug in, probably with your folks that focus on the wildlife stuff as well.
Yeah, and so, you know, we used a couple of DFW data sets in like the listed candidate wildlife species, the number per HOP 6. You know, at this stage of the prioritization, DFW felt, you know, at the HOP 6 level across the whole state, we don't need to say, well, is the, because in some areas you want to avoid treating for habitat issues and others you might want to treat. And at that course, Eastern Washington level, we didn't differentiate. But when we get into the planning area, that's where we will differentiate and need the feedback of all the various landowners. And so what we need to come up with is efficient ways for that dialogue to happen, because I drove to Colville twice, Wenatchee three times, Trout Lake, all in the month of January. And so we need to just figure out how to, at the Olympia level and the region level, make that sort of body of knowledge and feedback loop as efficient as possible. One mechanism is the collaboratives, you know, is one mechanism of that. We might need to create some working groups for each of these planning areas or something, you know, to really hammer through these issues and to have the type of deep dialogue that we need to have on some of these issues. So we're gonna have to build that.
Member Nelson?
Yeah, I had a question for you too. I had a very optimistic plan, but how are you gonna use the good neighbor policy that the commissioner signed into, or how are you actually going to get onto the Forest Service to do some on the ground work is my concern. Because having gone through their NEPA process, it's an endless process and it certainly doesn't fit into a biennium or into a century.
Yeah, no, it's ambitious. I would say in Northeast Washington, I think the vision of this plan is attainable. The Colville National Forest is pretty much at the level they need to be at. So what we need to do is help them sustain that. In the Eastern Cascades, the levels of treatment are far less, and there's some issues to get clarity on. Can we really do landscape scale restoration in those landscapes? And you know, one issue is NEPA, one issue is capacity. You know, the Okanagan Wenatchee National Forest is a big forest. So certainly we'll be using Good Neighbor to implement treatments. I could see us potentially, maybe we have a Good Neighbor NEPA team, right? To bring added capacity to conduct NEPA. You know, I think hopefully part of the value, I think, of the state taking some of the analysis lead is that maybe that can save 6 months to a year once we really get rolling. There's some challenges that, you know, a lot of challenges that we'll need to work through. One of which is currently we're pretty well set up to do the veg analysis for the NEPA side of things. But in order to really move the timeline forward, we need to have aquatics happening concurrent, right, with our, you know, our veg analysis. And so currently, we don't have the capacity in-house to do that, so we'd be relying on partners. Eventually, maybe once there's sort of agreed to methodology on how to evaluate aquatic restoration needs in these watersheds, then eventually maybe we can take that on in sort of a streamlined approach. So.
Another
Sabine.
Do you still have a sort of, I know that you had this great citizen advisory stakeholder group that helped put this plan together. Do you have an equivalent one for implementation, kind of on a statewide look, or are you just relying on the collaboratives?
Yes, we do have a Forest Health Advisory Committee that is a standing body that was authorized in Senate Bill 5546. We just had a meeting last week, and we will be meeting quarterly to sort of be the statewide synthesis of all the local feedback and to keep that sort of statewide understanding, because this is all a matter of being on the same page. And we don't need to align 100%, but we need to align probably 70%, right? And it's gonna take us a couple of years to really dial that in. But so yeah, that advisory committee will play a key role.
Thank you. Thank you.
Board Member Davis.
You were saying that up in the Caldwell National Forest, you were saying they're kind of there. Can you explain a little bit more what you mean by that, in that the collaborative is working, or the relationship with the other landowners is working well?
What I meant by that is that the Caldwell National Forest is there in terms of they're going to be treating about 5% of the forest on any given year. And so that's a 20-year cycle, which, you know, is about where you need to be, right? And so dialing in all the other landowners so that they're going to the same place and roughly the same time the Forest Service is, we'll need to build on that.
Board Member Gunther.
Yes, on the collaboratives you mentioned a couple times, are there any means to support the administrator of those collaboratives? Being a member of the Pinch of Partners for 15 years, I know that we've just struggled to pay our administrator.
Yeah, no, I'm well aware that most of the collaboratives have a pretty shoestring budget, and the state in their capital budget just provided about $250,000 for this biennium to support capacity for collaboratives. That's a first-time investment, and hopefully we can grow that over time, because we're gonna need conveners to facilitate these dialogues at the local level, and so they're sort of a natural body for that. They already have the relationships, a lot of the players there. We might need to add some players to the table in certain landscapes. So yes, there will be funding for that.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Chuck? Board Member Davies.
If maybe I missed this, but when we were talking about the different layers that you use, drinking water and different habitat and fire risk and that sort of thing, was there a waiting? How did you do the waiting?
There was no waiting.
No waiting.
No waiting.
So in other words, people.
Yeah, so for instance, the only way there was some waiting is we combined the three aquatics layers into one score of aquatic system health that was weighted equally with all these other. In the same way, there were two wildlife layers that we combined. So combined wildlife were all weighted equally with WUI, drinking water, et cetera. And then we weighted the tiers equally, the tier one for tier two, to sort of just keep it straight. And an interesting thing to note is that when we went and met with the Okanagan Wenatchee National Forest, they had done a prioritization. And I would say there was 70 to 80% alignment between our high priority watersheds and theirs. And they used similar sorts of data sets, but they did a lot of weighting. You know, there's many ways to get at probably relatively the same answer. And we just kept it simple to see what was driving it.
Any other questions for Chuck? Board Member Wolf.
Do we have any idea or any analysis on the amount of jobs that would be created through this?
Not to a rigorous extent yet. I think that's something we would like to build on as we get a better picture of volumes coming off of these potential projects and, you know, the labor going into them. I think we went some of the way down that road when we developed the plan, but we really need probably a full-blown economic study to really give credence to that.
Just in addition to that, in the Gifford Pinchot right now, we have a sale for 11 million board feet. We did not get a bidder, not one bidder, bid on that project because of the opportunities for the logging industry to have a lot of jobs. There's a lot of work. And we didn't get a bidder. 7 years to get that 11 million feet out.
What was the relationship between
the collaborative?
Why you didn't get a bid?
There's some helicopter logging. There's some restrictions.
there's so many easier opportunities out there.
Easier opportunities, yeah. And we didn't get any bids. So, you know, that's a stewardship project. So just to let you know, that's part of the problem.
Well, yeah, and I think we're going to need to build some markets in eastern Washington, certainly, because there's big areas with no mills. And so to really have this plan happen, especially in the eastern Cascades, probably need a mill or two.
Exactly.
Just
to Board Member Will's question. There's some good data salmon restoration, job creation. You know, it's very different, but they show that for every $1 million in restoration, it's about 24 jobs full time.
Yeah, there are some studies out there. The Ecosystem Workforce Group has done good work, so that can give us some multipliers. I'd like to have similar sorts of folks look at our example and come up with some, because that's definitely part of the story around this all. Taking the goals that are in this plan, what would be the economic development, you know, to, because I could come up with some crude numbers based off of some of those multipliers. I think it's worth a bit of a rigorous look too. Some of the collaborators have done some economic studies based off of like the Caldwell National Forest as part, they're part of the Collaborative Forest Restoration Landscape Program, where they have some funds for monitoring, and they've done some sort of studies around that. But I think the state would be well served to have a bigger economic look at this whole endeavor. You know.
Any other questions? Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you, guys.
Karen?
Good afternoon. I'm Garen Andrews, and I'm the Compliance Monitoring Program Manager. And I'm very excited to finally get to address the board today. This has been a long time coming. We've got a lot of exciting things to discuss and a lot of information to get through today. I'm going to be talking about the 2014-2015 Compliance Monitoring Biennial Analysis, the program study redesign that we went through in 2014. And the results and recommendations from the independent scientific peer review that we also went through very recently. Because it's been a long time since I've got an opportunity to present, I'll be going through a lot of material today. I just want to let you guys know that you can find additional information can be found in the 2014-2015 biennial report. And I'll be providing section numbers and page numbers on the slides themselves throughout this presentation. So the Compliance Monitoring Program was established in 2006 as a key component of a feedback loop that was intended to improve compliance with forest practices and rules by identifying needs for enforcement, training, educational opportunities, and rule and board manual updates. Unfortunately, for 2014, though, we evaluated for prescription samples as either wholly compliant or wholly non-compliant, which led to wide confidence intervals and limited information about individual specific rule non-compliance. With these issues in mind, the program set out to develop a new study program design that could address these issues through four major objectives. The first was to increase statistical precision by shrinking the Y confidence intervals. We would like to calculate average compliance by prescription type through evaluating individual rules and building in more flexibility to combine or subtract prescription types. And as a matter of fact, before I go any further, I'd just like to point out that we actually did accomplish that last one by combining the no outer zone harvest prescription type with the no winter zone harvest prescription type. They were made up of the exact same rules for both prescriptions. The resulting changes were to analytical methodology and not to field data collection procedures. we now calculate average compliance by taking the total number of compliant rules for each prescription type and dividing it into the total number of evaluated rules for each prescription type, which gives us our mean compliance rate. Also, prescription sample sizes are now calculated using three independent variables in an effort to control the compliance error rates. We calculate prescription sample sizes using the previous 5 years of data for variance, which is how far the data set is spread out from the mean, cluster size, which is the average number of rules evaluated per prescription, and prescription population size. Going into a little bit more in depth into prescriptions, the compliance monitoring program defines prescriptions as groups of rules that make up a timber harvest as indicated on a forest practices application. The compliance monitoring program samples 9 unique standard prescription types, and they are in no particular order. Desired future condition option 1, which allows for thinning in the inner zone from below. Desired future condition option 2, which extends the no-cut core zone into the inner zone. No inner zone harvest. Non-fish-bearing perennial streams. Non-fish-bearing seasonal streams. Type A and B wetland management zones. Forest wetland management zones. And finally, 2 a little bit more unique prescription types. First is roads, and I just a quick aside about roads. Each road segment is evaluated on an FPA. Therefore, the same rule may actually be evaluated multiple times, which can result in fractional compliance or fractional non-compliance. And you'll actually see this when we get into results a little bit later on. And finally, haul routes. And what makes haul routes a little bit different is that we do not evaluate individual rules within the haul route prescription type. Instead, we evaluate haul routes by distance. And again, I'll get into that in a little bit greater detail as we get further on into the report. So, for the 2014-2015 sample, just a few basic bullet points I'd like to introduce. First of all, we only were able to conduct 40% of our biennial sample in 2014 as a result of staffing turnover and the program study redesign, which I previously mentioned. The remaining 60% of the biennial sample was collected in 2015. We did not conduct an emphasis sample or any pilot studies during the sampling window. However, we began an ongoing trend analysis project, which can allow us to observe trends in prescription and individual rules. And we submitted the 2014-2015 biennial report along with the new study design for independent scientific peer review. And I'll be getting into the trend analysis and independent scientific peer review a little bit later on as well. So this table here, this depicts the sample and population sizes for the 9 standard prescription types for the 2014-2015 sampling window. Real quick, the compliance monitoring program defines populations as completed forest practices applications for the sample year with at least 1 observed instance of 1 of the 9 standard sample prescription types. So just to provide a real quick brief breakdown, if we look here at the very bottom, this is DFC2. So we calculated or estimated that there was a total population of 157 DFC2s, and we sampled 14. As I mentioned previously, that sample size was derived from the previous 5 years of data for DFC2 for cluster size, variance, and prescription population size. And that was then replicated for all the other 8 prescription or standard sample prescription types. Additionally, to rule compliance, we also collect data regarding water type. For 2014-2015, the compliance monitoring program evaluated 187 unique water type segments. And real quick, what I mean by that is that these were segments of, these are prescriptions or samples that we had selected out of the prescriptions. Aside from haul routes and roads, we didn't do any water typing evaluation with our haul routes and roads. So of the 187 unique water type segments that we evaluated, we observed 28 water typing discrepancies. And those can be broken down further into three categories. The first is we observed 11 segments to be underclassified for physical characteristics and or the observed presence of fish indicate that the segment should have been typed at a higher order on the hierarchical water, on the hierarchical water type system. An example of this would be an NP stream or NP segment that we selected that met fish physical characteristics without an approved water type modification form. There were 10 water segments that were determined to be overclassified, where physical characteristics indicate that the water segment should have been typed at a lower level on the hierarchical water typing system. An example of this would be an NS stream that was either determined to be a swale or the channel had no connectivity. And finally, there were 6 water segments that were determined to be indeterminate, where the compliance monitoring field team did not have enough information to be able to make a water typing determination. This is typically as a result of some sort of physical impediment, i.e. waterfall, or some sort of safety issue. Okay, so here are our results for 8 of our standard prescription types. I'll get into haul routes a little bit more in depth in a couple slides. There's a lot of information on this slide, so I'll just give you guys a quick breakdown of DFC1 to help with the interpretation for the rest of the table. So for DFC1, for 2014 and 2015, we sampled a total of 20 DFC1s, out of which there were 139 rules in which we evaluated. Of the 139 evaluated rules, 131 were found to be compliant, resulting in a 94% compliance rate. Of the 131 compliant rules, 13 were actually found to exceed the requirement of rule. Example of this would be something like where there are excess outer zone leave trees. Of the eight non-compliant rules, 7 were found to have low or minor deviation from the rule. This was the result of missing trees within the 12-inch diameter class for the interzone harvest strategy, or missing outer zone trees. And there was one instance of moderate deviation, which was the result of harvesting of trees larger than the DFC1 strategy allowed for. Along with the analysis, we also set an objective of plus or minus 6% confidence interval half-life, where you see here the yellow bar, and I'm sorry, the color got a little, I guess, kind of messed up a little bit. It looks more gold up there, where the gold or yellow bar is intersected by the black arrow line. Represents the midpoint or the half width of the confidence interval. As I mentioned, we set an objective of plus or minus 6% for our analysis. And fortunately, all prescription types met this except for no interzone harvest, and it had a resulting confidence interval half width of 6.5%. Which partially led to a increase in sample sizes in subsequent years. And as I mentioned before, getting into haul routes a little bit. Haul routes, there are no individual rules that make up the haul route prescription type. Instead, compliance monitoring only evaluates sediment delivery to live water along the Howell Route by 10th mile segments. So for the 2014-2015 sampling window, we assessed 67.4 miles of haul routes, of which a little bit more than 90%, or 61.5 miles, was found to have de minimis or no sediment delivered. Of the 9%, or 5.9 miles, of observed sediment delivery, the major primary causes were as follows. 44% was a result of sediment delivery from stream-adjacent parallel roads. 17% was defined or determined to be other, which we define as non-point source sediment delivery or block sediment, block drainage structures. 14% was the result of faulty cross drainage, and 10% was the result of inadequate water crossing structures. The remaining primary cause categories accounted for less than 3/10 of a mile each, respectively. And aside from just calculating compliance rates for by rule, we also calculate FPA compliance, where we evaluate forest practices activity with what was stated on the forest practices application. In other words, essentially what we're looking at is, did the proponent on the FPA do what they said they would do? Typically what we see are compliance rates that are pretty typical or is pretty similar to the rule compliance rates. However, sample sizes are not based on FPA compliance results and analysis, which can lead to higher variance and wider confidence intervals. And as I've mentioned before, we began a ongoing trend analysis project back in 2014, in which we incorporated data collected by the program from as far back as 2010. We believe that the observation of trends over time will allow the program to target individual rules that experience chronic low compliance for possible clarification, training, and updates. Data collected during the previous study design, in other words, prior to 2014, was converted to ensure consistent application of compliance across the total data set. Data that was collected not in accordance with protocols, was incomplete or unconvertible, was discarded from analysis. This actually played out with NP data that was collected during 2010 and 2011. That data, unfortunately, was unconvertible and unable to be used for trend analysis. For analysis, we employed a linear regression where we set the significance level at less than or equal to a p-value of 0.1. And just real quick, a p-value is the probability of a given statistics model, where the lower the p-value, the greater the potential for significance. The observation of trends over time should improve or increase as we collect and analyze more data. Also, I'd like to mention that the haul routes are not part of the trend analysis project, because there are no individual rules that make up the haul routes. And unfortunately, calculated p-values ended up being greater than 0.1 for DFC1, DFC2, NP, NS, Type A and B wetland management zones, and forest wetland management zones. However, significant results were detected in the no-winter zone harvest type, where we observed compliance rates between 89 and 94% and a resulting weighted p-value from the linear regression equation of 0.07. We were able to observe a year-over-year increase in compliance of 1% in the prescription type. And additionally, roads was also found to be significant, where compliance rates were observed between 94 and 100%, and a resulting weighted p-value of 0.035. But we were able to observe an increasing compliance year over year of 1.4%. Okay, so I've already covered quite a bit of information, and so I figured I'd give you guys an opportunity to ask any questions you guys may have regarding the 2014-2015 results and trend analysis. After this, I'll get into the independent scientific peer review, and also there'll be another opportunity again to ask additional questions.
Questions from board members? Board Member Davies?
I don't understand the table. Clarify why, like, that one chunk of data, I think you said it was, some chunk of data that was not convertible.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that?
So the 2010-2011 NP data set we found to be unconvertible, honestly, because we had trouble interpreting some of the data collection sheets from back then. Yeah.
Board Member Nelson.
He had a question for you. We've been talking about water typing and FN breaks for quite a while today. But if I read this correctly on page 28 of your report, you looked at NP streams in the 2014 and 15 season for compliance monitoring. And those would be the streams that if they weren't properly, they were underclassified and would slip into the fish category. Or if they were overclassified, they would slip into the NS category, correct?
Yes.
Well, of the 187 total that you looked at, 11 of those were underclassified and 10 of them were overclassified. So you pretty much split the difference on those. 11 of them probably should have been fish streams, and 10 of them probably should have been NSs.
Yeah, and to actually provide a little bit further breakdown, so what you mentioned is a situation where an NP stream may also, it may have been determined to actually be F. But that underclassification also includes type A and B wetland management zones and forest wetland management zones. There was a few instances where fish were observed in a forested wetland, and I believe that there was another instance where a type B wetland was determined by a specialist to actually be a bog. And so really what we're saying is that these segments would have fallen or required a different set of rules.
Specifically what you said was 9 that were underclassified actually met fish habitat criteria, and of the 9, 5 of them were actually wetlands, so mm-hmm. which aren't happy fish.
Yeah.
Okay. Board Member?
Any other questions from board members on this segment? Okay, keep going here.
All right. Like I said, there'll be an opportunity to ask more questions. Okay, so as the final element of the program study redesign, in an effort to test the validity of the new study design, the compliance monitoring program submitted the completed and final 2014-2015 biennial report along with the program analytical design for independent scientific peer review. The Compliance Monitoring Program, along with the Department of Natural Resources, requested that the ISPR team be made up of scientists with expertise in statistics, quantitative ecology, resource management, forest biometry, and silvicultures. And real quick before I move on, there's additional information regarding the ISPR and the process. Along with the submitted questions and responses can be found in the synthesis and assessment from ISPR handout. I believe that should have been part of the board handout. The Compliance Monitoring Program pursued an open review where we met with ISPR team members on multiple occasions to help answer their questions and provide feedback and clarity so they could better conduct their analysis with a clear understanding of the compliance monitoring program and its corresponding methodologies. for the review, a mix of questions, standard questions that the adaptive management program typically asks ISPR, eight questions, and programmatic specific questions that covered analytical methodology, results interpretation, study reproducibility, and report clarity, which mostly come up or have actually commonly come up in conversations with our stakeholders over the past 2 years, were submitted to ISPR. And these questions should be in the handout provided to you guys, so you can see them. It's a little, I know it's a little busy up there with all of the words. The independent scientific peer review team concluded that the current analytical approach to calculating prescription compliance rates is generally sound. However, they did make two major recommendations for programmatic improvement. The first was to expand the current Appendix A in the report to include how one gets from the FDA to the prescription, from the prescription to the rules, and ultimately to the estimate of compliance. It is believed that this will help improve report clarity and the reproducibility of the study. The second major recommendation was to use a jackknife form of the current ratio estimator to help reduce potential bias in estimating average rule compliance for prescriptions that have a smaller number of FPA samples.
Can you explain what a jackknife?
Oh, I'll get into a little bit of an explanation here. And then additionally, ISPR made some minor grammatical and punctuation recommendations that have already been incorporated into the 14-15 report and will be incorporated into all future subsequent reports as long as the verbiages continue to be used. So one of the things that ISPR concluded was that the ratio estimator, or the way that we have been calculating compliance, can be biased, meaning that the estimate based on a sample might be systematically or higher or lower than the true population value. So as a result of small sample sizes relative to large population sizes, bias may exist within our data set. So we developed a Python script to run in R and be applied to the 2016-2017 data set and all future data sets. So to try to provide a little bit of a description of jackknife analysis and apologies if I don't do a very good job of describing it, we can try to go into greater detail in the question and answer. So jackknife analysis is a resampling technique useful for variance and bias estimates, where the jackknife estimator is determined by systematically leaving out each observation from the data set and then calculating the estimate, and then taking an average of all of those estimates. And then finally, the compliance monitoring program is also currently rewriting the Appendix A to include a description of the random selection process of FPAs, an explanation of why the simple random estimate approach works statistically, examples of compliance analysis for individual rules within prescriptions, and examples of how sample sizes are determined. Okay, so that's what I have prepared for you guys today. If you have any questions regarding independent scientific peer review or the 2014-2015 results and trend analysis, I'd be happy to answer any of them at this time.
So, one comment, and then we'll have to yield to the board members. But the ISPR analysis, one of the things when I came back to DNR been many criticisms about the compliance monitoring program over the years, and it hadn't had a third-party review. And so that's one of the things that took on early in my tenure back here. And so I was really appreciative of Karen's tolerance to go through that review with Hans's help and actually show that the new sampling was actually working for us, so.
And I was just wondering if you ran the results of the ISPR by technical stakeholders to see if they...
Yeah, we sat down with, I believe back in August, we sat down with our stakeholder and went through the ISPR process, yeah, and the results and recommendations.
And so did people feel better after that? Did the criticism go down, or was there still a lot of, you know, that's great, but we still think this is, needs improvement?
I would say that there was a general relief that we are going in the right direction. The stakeholders still had questions, and how we were going to address some of that stuff. But I think for the most part, yeah, I think that it probably eased some people's minds about the program and things like that. It certainly eased mine. It was one of the things that I really wanted to do when I got here as well. I wanted to test the validity of the study design myself.
Any questions from board members for Karen? Board Member Davies?
In addition to the review that you got from the independent design review, did you get any substantive comments for improvements from the stakeholder group?
From that August meeting? Yeah, I mean, so one of the things, so we meet periodically with our stakeholder group, usually once or twice a year, where we go over lots of things, typically what the program's been up to, results, stuff like that. They provide feedback a lot on what they feel that the program can improve upon, or what it should be pursuing, things like that. Yeah, that's pretty typical as part of the process with them, yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
So another change in the agenda because of timing. I'd like to ask Kate Nicholson and Abby Gleason if you want to the geology division, currently called the Washington Geological Survey, has been, board members have requested in the past an update on LIDAR and on our landslide database on the web portal so that players know where to go for information on landslides. And so they're here to basically demonstrate what's going on.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, please introduce yourselves.
My name is Kate Nicholson. I'm a geologist with the Washington Geological Survey, and I specialize in landslides.
Good afternoon. I'm Abby Gleason. I'm the LIDAR manager for the Washington Geological Survey.
So I'm going to start by giving an overview of the landslide program at the Washington Geological Survey. So our target audience for our products are planners, emergency managers, public works, and the public. The products that we're delivering are landslide hazard maps based on best available science, which we are using LIDAR data. We're hoping that this data is used to evaluate the potential hazard to people and property when considering development. So we're hoping that cities and counties are incorporating this data into their building codes and into their critical areas ordinances. And that in turn can help decide what are the best land uses and construction methods in these hazard zones. Overall, we're hoping to create a disaster resilient population. So our products, we're creating inventory maps and susceptibility maps. We're doing a phased mapping approach. So phase one is a detailed landslide inventory. This is an inventory, and each landslide has a specific set of attributes tagged onto it. The mapping extent is limited. We're mostly mapping where there's infrastructure, so where people live and work. We're also doing phase 1A. This is a streamlined landslide inventory protocol, or SLIP mapping. This is done in remote areas, and so it's just a simplified, I'll explain this in a few slides from now, but there's no attributes associated with this mapping. Phase two, we're doing deep and shallow landslide susceptibility mapping. So we're trying to predict where landslides might occur in the future. The detailed inventory in Oregon, at the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, they created this protocol for mapping landslides on LIDAR that was published in 2009. This is a well-received protocol. There's many states and different companies using this protocol. So we adapted this protocol to meet the needs of Washington State, and we published this in April of last year. So what we're doing is we're mapping landslide deposits off the LIDAR. So on figure B, we're mapping the deposits as a polygon. See, there's that light yellow polygon on top, that's the head scarp, so where the landslide's pulling away from the slope. And then figure D, we're mapping internal features as lines. Each landslide deposit in the detailed inventory has a series of attributes associated with it. So that includes movement type, how confident we are that it's a landslide, did we field verify it, and estimates in landslide size. So the SLIP mapping, this is the simplified landslide mapping. What we're doing, instead of parsing out each individual piece of the landslide, we're just making one polygon that encompasses all the head scarp and any internal features of the deposit itself. Lower confidence landslides, we're digitizing as points. If we have time within the project, we will go back and create polygons for these points. And then the only attribute associated with them, each of these polygon or points, is how confident we are it's a landslide, so low, moderate, or high. For susceptibility mapping, we're also using protocols developed by the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. For shallow susceptibility, this is special paper 45. This uses generalized slope properties, soil properties, excuse me, so the slope gradient, and we're putting that into something called the factor of safety formula. It's important to note that the landslide susceptibility data are not intended for use in assessing potentially unstable slopes for proposed forest management activities, such as logging and forest road construction. We finished a project in Pierce County last year. This was the current layer that they were using at the time to regulate development. After we did our shallow landslide susceptibility map, we reduced the hazard area by 59%. We went back and we mapped shallow landslides off aerial photos as points. And we had a 99.6% capture rate with those points, and there was a little over 300 points. For the deep landslide susceptibility mapping, we're again using protocols out of Oregon. This takes into account susceptible geologic units, susceptible contacts, the slope, and then preferred direction of movement of some of these slides. All of this data is available on our portal, which Abby will talk about next after me. This is a section of Pierce County. I have all the layers turned on for the landslide right now, but you can click them on and off so you can see the shallow and the deep susceptibility and then the landslide deposits. And if you click on one of those landslide deposits, it will pop up all the attributes associated with that polygon. So we just finished Pierce County last year. We're currently mapping in King County and then in the Columbia River Gorge. After that, we're moving up to Whatcom County. And then future projects include the city of Spokane and then Snohomish and Skagit counties. So that's my brief overview, if anyone has any questions.
Okay,
One of the benefits, I assume, doing the landslide mapping is that I know we have a broad layer on the web portal with lots of polygons and many different sources that were put together some time ago. And there's a lot of false positives in that layer.
Correct.
So I'm assuming this will help us refine that layer to, and get more specific so that we don't have some of those.
Yes, and so this, by following these protocols, it's a systematic way of mapping the landslides. So we're guaranteeing that all these landslides are mapped in the same manner. And where, so for Pierce County that was published, that data set is stamps out that old data. That old data is still available if people want to see it, but available on our portal is the latest and greatest, this new landslide mapping. And so as we continue to systematically map throughout the state, we'll be cleaning up that old data set.
And you're not just using LiDAR, are you? Or are you just, is that your primary?
Yes, so we're just using LiDAR. We do have within our protocols the ability to map on aerial photos, but it's just using a point. But we currently are doing that.
Any other questions for board members? Board member Janke.
So let me see if I can ask this correctly. So Skagit County, I know, tagged onto the state contract when LIDAR data was collected, and so they flew other portions of our county because we're in the process of adding those LIDAR layers to our own GIS. So will it, I guess where I'm trying, will it be possible for a county with the right software or GIS system in place to be able to overlay the slide analysis with our housing or development maps?
Yeah, so when we're, we've only worked with Pierce County and we're currently working with King County and the Gorge, but we work hand in hand with those counties when we're doing this project. So we're coming to the county before we start mapping to let them know this is what's coming your way. This is give an overall kind of generalized talk, kind of what I did today. And then we'll be with them step by step throughout the process. They'll get a review period of the data. And then afterwards, we're hoping to work hand in hand to how to incorporate that data. But yes, it's in GIS and you should be able to overlay it with any other layers in GIS.
Okay, it's great. I mean, it's such great technology, and it's nice to see the collaboration so that we get meaningful information out of all the data.
Hey, I'm sorry, did you address the prioritization you're using to?
Yeah, can we be up there closer to the top? Oh, no.
unfortunately, that's not my decision. My boss, Stephen Slaughter, who's on vacation today, he could address where on the list everyone falls. And, but I just know where we're going next.
Okay. Any other questions for Kate?
It's very good. Okay. It's very cool, and I love to see that there's two ladies up there who are in charge of all this really cool technology. Okay.
So now we'll be going through the LIDAR program and also the web portals that we have to address public distribution of our data. So a quick overview of the talk today, the LIDAR program overview and collection priorities. So I'm going to go through what the program is, the concept and basis for it, also where do we have LIDAR now, where are we collecting, where are we going in the future, the prioritization of that, some of that in the future work. And also, how do we distribute that data? How do we collect that data? I'll be demonstrating the LIDAR portal, and also I'll be demonstrating the geologic information portal. Those are our two portals, primary portals that we have in the Washington Geological Survey to serve out our data. So, first of all, the Washington LIDAR program, usually I just start off like, what is LiDAR data? I think most people here recognize what LiDAR data is, but just to get everybody on the same page, it stands for light detection and radiation. It uses a pulsed laser to measure at a distance, typically from the sensor of the plane to the ground, and that's measuring the elevation. So we can get really precise measurements that are highly accurate within about 10 to 15 centimeters or better. And this creates what we call a dense point cloud. That's the native format of LiDAR data, is this point cloud, or what we sometimes call LES files. And then those returns can be filtered. That's the kind of amazing power of LiDAR data, is you have all of these returns from various different points of elevation, the tops of the trees, the middle of the canopy, the vegetation layers, and the bare earth, the bare ground. So we often say like last return, first return, and then you can take those points, filter them down, and create different surfaces or visual elevation models from that. So the program background, in 2015, I always think that the part that's going to go wrong is the live demo, but you know, that's probably going to go right today. All right, so hopefully we can get this going. All right, so in 2015, well, the legislation approved of the funding for our program. As you can imagine or know, that this came mostly out of the Oso landslide to formulate the hazards program that we now have, and also the land LiDAR collection. Really realizing the power that we had LiDAR before the slide and then after the slide to understand and characterize the hazards. So, overall, our goals are to help improve the understanding of geologic hazards from LiDAR data. This, you know, of course, goes hand in hand with the landslide risk that we just talked about with Kate's presentation. Also, coordinate and manage and support high-quality LiDAR collections for all applications. So we've done, you know, really recognize the hazards applications for LiDAR data within the geological survey, but of course, there are so many other applications, forestry being one of the largest. But there's also other applications for wildfire, other applications for agriculture, and also aquaculture. There's just so many different applications for LiDAR data that we want to collect the highest quality we can to serve all of those applications. So we want, sure.
Question, Board Member Davies.
Background, so you're saying that the work that you're doing can be used for forestry applications, whereas the prior presentation in the beginning part was, you clarified, you highly emphasized that that was not to be used in forestry applications. Am I, is that right?
Well, I think, so the base LiDAR data can serve actually all those applications. So if we go back a few slides, you can kind of get the idea from, this from here. So when you collect LiDAR data, you're actually getting information from all these different layers, I guess, so you could say, the canopy and the bare earth. And so when we're doing like landslide and hazards mapping, we're typically using the bare earth data that's filtering out those points. Basically, the LiDAR points are tagged with the information of where they came from within that point cloud. So you're filtering out those top surface points to just get the bearers. And because of that, you can see the landslides underneath the vegetation. But you can use all of the points or the top surface points to get information on the canopy structure itself. Or sometimes you look at change over time, get an understanding of how forest growing or rates, also heights, volumetrics, and all of that. So you're using all of the information versus for hazards, you're usually using part of the information or the bare earth information.
I just wanted, because you emphasized a disclaimer, and I just wanted to get clear.
Right, so I'm using the data that Abby's collecting for a specific purpose that is not intended for forest practices. But that data that Abby's collecting can be used by a lot of different scientists, including
your service, it's not the forestry.
Right.
Yeah, so essentially with this program, we're collecting the data and then becoming the data stewards of that, and then everyone can access that data. So within our program, we also have the mission to complete quality assurance for the data that we have, with regards to the data that we've inherited through the several years that LIDAR's been going on throughout the state. But also for our new collection, so that's a service that we provide within our program is to do that QA analysis, but also create a standardized collection so that we can serve that out to the public and the public knows what standard that's coming out to them. As you can imagine, data's been collected over the past two decades in any standard, and we're trying to make that easier for the public to interpret. Right, so this map is showing the current LIDAR coverage or extent that we have in the state. As you can see, we have a lot of coverage, especially on the west side of the state in the Puget Sound region, but we also have a fair bit in the eastern side as well. But I do want to caveat that these collections have been done over time, so the quality and the resolution vary over time. Technology has actually progressed and changed over time. And in general, our data is a 3-foot resolution raster, or for the digital elevation models that come in 3-foot raster, but that can also vary with the vintage of the LIDAR collection, so it could be something different than that as well. Several areas have repeat coverage, which is fantastic for change detection if you're looking at how forests grew over time. In the past 10 years or so, we have some repeat coverages where they can address that and do that analysis. Some examples are the Tootle River and the Elwha River. And this data, or the extent that I'm showing here, this is what's publicly available. This is what we're trying to make sure it's publicly distributable. So this is kind of an example of that quality and resolution example. So this is data that was collected in King County. It probably doesn't show through as well on the screen, so I apologize for that. This was done in 2003, and this area here is looks tinny, or it looks triangulated on the screen. This is where the over-interpolation was done. And so this was a limitation of the technology at the time. You're not getting as clear information about the terrain in this area. Hopefully this clears up a little bit here. So this is what we just collected in 2016 for King County. And all of a sudden, features like drainages, alluvial fans are starting to become much more clear where these are and in relationship to this road layer here. So this is why technology changes, keeping up to date with new LIDAR data really matter. And that's why also it's good to keep in mind the quality and the resolution of the data that you are downloading for area as well. So this new data set has definitely cleared up and created a better understanding of how these geologic features or these landforms are interacting with this road layer here, and this road here happens to be Interstate 90, so it's a pretty good area to really understand and characterize. So this is a quick look at where we've been collecting in the last 2 years, and we started this in 2016. So it was mentioned earlier, the collections done in Whatcom, Skagit, King County. These were done in the last 2 years. It was part of a collection we did with the USGS through their 3D elevation program. And we also partnered with King County and the Puget Sound LiDAR Consortium to do these collections. This was part of our 3-deck collection with the USGS as well. So we definitely targeted really large areas to get consistent, really up-to-date coverage in these areas where generally they, a lot of them had coverage before, but they were done very early on in the early 2000s. And that technology change that I highlighted in the last slide, we really want to take advantage of that and recapture those areas that are in very high population areas and also very high hazard risk areas, and can also be used for the variety of applications that I mentioned earlier. And the reason we were able to map such a large area was really through collaboration and partnerships through the USGS, but also the county, Skagit County, Whatcom County, Snohomish County, Lewis County, all those partnerships are, really play a huge part in how much area we can collect and then the work that can be done afterwards with it. So as I mentioned, we work with the USGS, other DNR divisions. We work with the Forest Resources Division. We work with the Forest Practices Division to collect this data. We work with local tribal entities, other state agencies. So there's a lot of collaboration here that goes on. And so some of this, what I'm pointing out here, are other areas that we were able to bring into our collections through those partnerships. For example, the USGS and through our wildfire division within our state agencies. So additional data that we were able to add to the data that we collected, as I showed on the previous screen, because of those partnerships. Here's where we're going this year, the next biennium. So with some emphasis on high population areas, high hazard areas, we're focusing on the west and the Olympic Peninsula here. We're filling in a lot of gaps where we didn't have LiDAR before, and we're also collecting data over areas that were done very early on in the early 2000s, trying to make that a much better LiDAR data set. For other collaborations with counties, we're collecting in Sarian, Columbia, Garfield down here as well. And then through our own contract, which I'll talk about a little bit later on, we're collecting some interesting projects in Yakima Basin, but also adding on to the King County collections. There's additional work by other agencies being done as well, and by opening up communication with them, we have knowledge about what's going on, be able to collect that and put it out to our public distribution as well once they're completed. So the Forest Service has been focusing a lot of attention on areas like in Gifford Pinchot and such, and then FEMA has also been putting a lot of emphasis on collecting large areas for their updating their risk maps on a monthly basis and whatnot. So by keeping those partnerships open, we'll be able to deliver that data to the public as well. So how we kind of break this down and to try to prioritize our funding and move forward, you know, each biennium, we kind of look at it on a regional scale. Reason being, we want to have some temporal consistency in each region so that we don't have kind of a close work of different data sets that have different temporal implications. LiDAR is a very temporally sensitive data set, so that, you know, each time the watershed changes, things can look different in the LiDAR data. So we do want to have some consistency across the region to help with get a good baseline or base map for people to work with. And so that's why we've broken it down into regions like this. So we've so far focused on Western Washington, as I mentioned, population centers and also hazards, and also updating LiDAR data sets that have been done several decades ago at this point. And then we're going to move into the Eastern Cascades. There's been a lot of interest in this area for forestry reasons, of course, health reasons, also habitat analysis, sound and recovery. And then, as I keep mentioning, collaborations with other agencies can only help us expand these areas and complete these in a timely fashion. I'll quickly go through our contract. So we do have a contract through the Washington Geological Survey that we can use. We use Quantum Spatial, which is a very well-known vendor in the Northwest. They have a lot of experience up here. But any federal, state, local agency, tribe, private agency, our company, and state agency can work with us as long as they have a point of contact within DNR to use that contract. We use 8 points per square meter, which is a pretty high standard of high density, but we do that so that we can serve all those applications. The understanding being if we collected the highest quality possible, any use or application could then use that data down the road and help create that base map. We also have bathymetric LiDAR and orthophoto options, so you can combine these newer technologies of bathymetric LiDAR with your analysis and also have an orthophoto with that LiDAR data to understand the picture of what the habitat and the now was like at the time. And we have 3 projects going under this contract right now, so we are gaining a lot of experience, and we do the QA work in-house to help cut down on the overhead for that. Because the program is funded, we don't have an overhead. As I mentioned, QA is done by the Washington Geological Survey. And it does offer some increased value when we can put it together with ARC funding. So if we do some pre-planning, you know, when our ARC funding cycle comes around, and also work with the USGS program, we can really create some efficiencies to do some large-scale projects. I mentioned collaboration a couple times, but that really is how we're collecting such large areas all at once. And so, and quickly, I'd like to go through the Washington LiDAR portal. So this is our portal that we created to do our public distribution. And so I wanted to run through it quickly just so people could see and how it works. Let's see if I can actually click on it. Of course, it went on my screen and not everyone else's screen. Sorry. Okay. Let's see if I can. Oh, that's simple. Trying to get this all figured out. I'm too ambitious trying to show too many things all at once. So given that, I'll just go through this and then launch right into the Washington Geological Commission portal as well. So this is the LiDAR portal. So we created this portal specifically for visualization and download so that people could easily download the area they wanted. This is our current extent that we have on our portal. We did just send about 4.5 terabytes worth of data, all of the new data from Snohomish, Skagit, Whatcom County, all of that is going up on the portal hopefully by the end of next week. So there will be a lot of new data up here in the near future. So basic tour of this, on the left-hand side, you have your table of contents. And as you zoom in, that actually changes dynamically, so you're only seeing the projects in your view and can get a good idea of how many projects are covering your area of interest. And there's actually quite a bit in King County. If you know kind of what you're looking for, so if I know there was a project done in Altamont, you can actually search for that here, and that will take you directly to that area. You can also pick your area of interest, and a lot of comments that we got early on when we were designing the portal is we don't need to download the entire data set. Sometimes these data sets are really, really large. We just want a few tiles, a few quadrangles. So we wanted to give that capability so you can basically draw your area of interest, and then it tells you right off the bat what projects you have in your area of interest, and it gives you all of the options for your products. So for this one, we don't have any point clouds, but you can choose your digital surface model, your digital terrain model. All of these terms are actually, there's a glossary with these terms in there, gives you some basic tips on how to use the portal. My contact information is down at the bottom, which hopefully is handy to everybody. It also gives you an idea of how large your download's going to be. So we know that download speeds vary, and these data sets can be quite large, and so we did want to give an idea of how large are these data sets, what are you downloading, etc. So let's see if I can find one that has point cloud. Another thing that we really wanted to focus on was the ability to download the point cloud, which is the most native format that LiDAR data has. A lot of people still are a little confused about how to use the point cloud. Not a lot of software programs out there natively use LAS files. But it's becoming more and more common. And ArcGIS now, you do have the capability to look at the point cloud natively. And so we want to offer that capability because there's a lot of information in all those points in the understory of the canopy and whatnot. Sometimes you just get with grassers the top or the bare earth. There's a lot of information in between about what the structure of the canopy is. So we wanted to have that capability for people to do a higher level analysis. It's interesting, I can't find it right now, but it has a point cloud. So that's something that our portal offers that a lot of portals, LiDAR portals, don't offer right now. It is a challenge. It's definitely a big data challenge to be able to do that, but it's something that we think is really quite important to offer. The visualization is also something that we really wanted to offer people because, oftentimes most of the questions are, what does my house look like, or what kind of terrain is my house on, and what is that? Just in general, what does that look like, or what's around me? So you can zoom in pretty well. This is all the native resolution of the data set itself. And you can also turn on the top surface, what we call the top surface, or the digital surface model, and take a look at your tree canopy. Where are your trees? Where are your buildings? Another huge use for LiDAR data are building footprints. And so a lot of people use these to extrude 3D building footprints. And so you can get a really good idea of what quality of data is this going to be for my building footprint layer. That's a pretty quick tour of the LiDAR portal. Do you have any questions about that? Will I set up the other portal?
Questions from the board members? Not a question, but a comment. It's we have LiDAR over our entire property, and one of the really utilities that we find in it is trying to correct the DNR hydro layer. Because when we go to do an FBAR and you pull up the topographic data, it's notoriously wrong. This helps a lot and gives you a lot more credibility when you turn it in and correct that. So just a comment. It's good stuff.
Thank you. That was an excellent comment. there are no other questions, I'll go into the geologic information.
I have a question, and it might actually be more for you or for forest practices staff. So is forest practices staff then accessing this regularly to review EAs or geology staff that services forest practices program?
Where it exists.
Okay, so I was also going to say that we do have GIS layers that you can add to your ARC section or any GIS that you choose to use. And also another way to get to the LIDAR data is actually through the Washington Geological Information Portal, which is what I'm attempting to look at right now. This is the actual table of contents for the portal. And it's expanded itself to the maximum extent. So in order to access this, you can go onto the DNR geology page, and then the geologic information portal pops up on the sidebar here, and then you can just navigate through here. And this wonderful volcano that we have is our timepiece. It's waiting, it's waiting. It's probably going to expand again. Probably not going to be good. Anyone have any tips on how to get it to not expand?
To what?
So the table.
You don't want this to expand?
Thank you. Okay, so sorry about that. The first thing that you see when you open this up, and of course it wouldn't be a live demo, something didn't go wrong, is the 1 to 500,000 K geology, actually. So the way you control that is turning the table of contents on, and so you can just turn that off. And for example, if you want to look at the landslide data that Kate mentioned in her talk, you can turn on the landslide inventory, which is the Pierce County data that they've been working on. The landslide compilations is also in here. So as she mentioned, that the new Pierce County data stamps that out, so you can kind of see how that works, where they have the most up-to-date data in Pierce County. That's where this exists. You can see the landslide compilations that are done for the state and other places as well. A couple other things, there's a lot of toolbars in here. It does often operate kind of like a GIS, so it has kind of a GIS feel, and that was very much on purpose when redesigning the new geology portal, to give some people who don't have GIS capabilities, we have a lot of customers who don't have access to GIS software, some capability to look at this data in the way that it was intended. So right now we're looking at volcanic hazards and events, and so you can kind of reorder on your home computer. This is not going to go up and blow up to the full screen, but you can reorder those just like you would in the GIS. You can look at identify each feature and look at the document. So if that has a document attached to it, you can actually open that up as a PDF right there. Couple other things, there's a legend. So, the legend doesn't automatically pop up, so if you didn't know what any of those letters were, you could look at that here. Locate, it's very similar to like the Google Maps or whatnot, and you type in the street address, or it also has some other features. Like if you have a particular township and range you're working in, you can search through it that way, search by county and whatnot. You can save your map, which is also kind of nice. So for example, users that don't have the GIS capability can save this, save a file on their desktop and actually come back to it later and reload all the layers they have been working with into a new session. And so it's like a, it's kind of like an MXD in a way. So load up everything you have been working with at a different time. You can also print that map. There's a help and glossary. So just like for the LiDAR portal, if you have any questions about what a tool does in the toolbar, and what are the terms that we're using, you can go to those specific areas and look that up. And we also have a feedback option, so you can send an email, you know, this is what I'm experiencing, do you have any information about this, or, you know, send us a survey on feedback. So this is pretty, the hope is it's very user intuitive, offers some capabilities that people can use natively here. The feature that I like the most is add data. My hope is that eventually our LiDAR portal will also have some of these features so that if a geotechnical firm or consultant needs to look at a specific area, they can actually add their own data, either it be from the website or a layer from file, for like, for example, a shapefile or a KML, load it in here and see, well, where does my data intersect everything else? You know, what do I have in my area of interest? And then it also has the LiDAR data. And I actually use this, or send people to this portal quite a bit to look at the LiDAR data in conjunction with a lot of our other geologic layers so they can see where you know, landslides might be in conjunction with their area of interest or whatnot. There's also a 3D option if you want to look at this in perspective view. See if that actually works here or not.
Board Member Davies, you got a question?
I just was going to ask you if there is, so it sounds like the two portals speak to each other.
They do.
And if somebody just Googled this, it would come up, it would be easy to find.
Yes, and so, and I typically just Google like Washington DNR Geology Portal or LiDAR Portal. And then come up with the first thing.
So and there's a help page. Is there so it's easy to figure out how to use it?
That's the hope. And it seems like so far people have been able to find it pretty intuitive, especially this portal. It went under a lot of reconstruction over the past year to make it user-friendly, intuitive, and also updated. It was on, the old portal was on Flash technology. This goes to JavaScript API, which is now heavily supported by Esri as well. And so after developing this one, I think we're going to also go back to the LiDAR portal and put some of these tools in there and help really make it look and feel very similar. So they do go hand in hand together now. We work well together looking at both. The LiDAR portal really is great for downloading. Specifically, but also make the open feel the same so people who know one portal can use the other.
Yeah.
That's it. So I just wanted to show those portals and now take any questions.
Questions from board members? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
All right, Vic and Tammy, thanks for being patient with us.
Bear that in mind.
So, Vic and Tammy are going to give us an update on what's going on with the small annular advisory group.
Chairman of the NAF and members of the board, I'm Vic Musselman. I'm chair of the Small Forest Landowner Office Advisory Committee. It has been a long time in coming for us to come and make a presentation to you about what the committee does. We have been working on this for almost a year now, so I'm really glad we finally were able to come and address you folks. And with me, of course, is Tammy Makita, who directs the Small Forest Landowner Office, and she will follow up my comments with a little talk about how we interact.
We
we have discussed many issues over the past couple of years, and I just want to give you the highlights of about a half dozen of them that were very important, we feel, to the confidence that the small forest owners of Washington have in being able to have resources available to manage and operate their timberlands and understand forest practices. We developed an ongoing and constantly updated action list that gives us direction on what is most important for us to take up at our meetings. At the start of the year, the list stood at 6 short-term projects and 5 long-term projects, ranging from developing a sample alternate plan, which is number 1, to clarifying language instructions for water typing, which I will address later. Members of the advisory committee have volunteered to head up an effort to create a sample alternate plan application that would be posted on a small forest owner office website. That is a work in progress, and we hope to complete that this year. We committed a considerable amount of time to creating a short guideline to instruct small forest landowners on what to expect if they are required to have an ID team convene and address an alternate plan or some other phase 4 criteria on their forest practice application. And I happen to have copies of those guides here, which I'll give to Patricia and she can pass out to you folks. Another item that we did, which it really increases the efficiency that we operate under, is last year we created a member handbook. And the purpose of the handbook is not only to for all the members to understand how we work together, but also gives the history of the development of the small forest landowner office and a small forest landowner office advisory committee. It is a good reference guide for us, a very useful tool, and we're glad that we have it. We did draft an email to the DNR Forest Practice Division Manager requesting that the advisory committee be part of the review process for any forest practices documents that are being altered. That formal letter was accepted, and the request was granted, which would allow the advisory committee to identify any language in new documents that could be confusing to small forest landowners. However, we noted that the instructions that have come out, which go into effect March 1st for the new water typing modification form, have several areas of ambiguity in them, and if we've already received complaints from some of our members. We wish we had been given the opportunity to review those instructions. We will be taking them up nevertheless. We also have decided to undertake a discussion of potential issues that small forest owners have had on a continuing basis, year in, year out, with the existing east side and west side FPA application and instructions. This has been ongoing since early in the fall. We have identified many, many issues. We have collated them, and when we're through, we still have issues to cover, which we hopefully will complete in our next meeting in March. When we are through, we will collate all of these issues and take them to operations and for their consideration and hopefully for their help in making the changes that would make the instructions for the FPA much more usable for small forest landowner offices. One thing I want to comment on too is that over the years we have cooperated with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and we've helped them with their outreach. Most recently, in the last 2 years, we helped them with their outreach on protection of the western gray squirrel and in developing the agreements and assurances for the recovery of the fisher. Now I'll turn it over to Tammy, and then we'll answer any questions when she is through.
And I'm just going to be very quick because I know it's been a long meeting for everybody. I just wanted to tell the board how much I appreciate the hard work and the dedication that each advisory committee member puts forth to help the small forest landowner issues and our concerns. They're always eager to tackle pertinent topics while maintaining a very mutual level of respect for the other committee members. And they've been very effective in helping my office in creating solutions. I value the open communication that we have between my office and between the advisory committee. And I appreciate our ongoing effective working relationship. So it's a very good working relationship, and I very much appreciate it. I wanted to tell the board how much I appreciate the work that they did.
Now we'll entertain any questions.
Any questions?
Questions from board members or Tammy or Nick? Board Member Davis?
I don't have a question, just to thank you for that, the help and that outreach. I think that's really, really important. On those things that are voluntary, it helps us prevent having to do a bunch of work here if we have folks that understand the process, and having the small forest landowner folks themselves help those landowners understand the process and help them get through it. I can't thank you enough for that help.
You're welcome. We have perfected a method of working well together as a group, as Tammy said, and reaching out to the other agencies. And if you'd want to turn over TFW policy, we'll get it done a lot faster for you.
Just a comment, if I could.
Board Member Gafford.
I'd like to make a comment that we all know how many small landowners there are in the state of Washington, and we know how much land they control. And you folks, the association represents a lot of those people that aren't paying dues to your organizations, but I'm sure that they appreciate the work you're doing. I know I sure do, and I do pay dues.
By that, I assume you're referring to the Washington Farm Forestry Association?
Yes.
Well, we are just members of that association, that populate committee.
But you're actually speaking for a lot of landowners
that
aren't in the associations. Thank you.
Again, you're welcome.
Any other board member questions or comments? Thank you, Dick.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Okay. Moving quickly, I guess what I'm going to ask the board is if you have any questions regarding the staff reports that you were providing. I do have one comment on one of the staff reports, so I'll wait to see if anybody wants to pick up staff on their staff reports. No?
I wanted some more information on the policy.
Hans? So Scott's not here today, so Hans is going to attempt to pinch it.
I just wondered, have we received a couple of letters from different stakeholders about the East Side? And hiring a scientist for CEMER for the East Side, and I just wonder where that is, and if you can maybe even a little bit of background, and there's a West Side person and not an East Side, I just wanted a little more information about that, and see where we are and how we can get someone on.
Good afternoon, Chairman Knapp, members of the board. I'm Hans Burgers, Cadet Management Program Administrator. And I'm filling in for Scott Swanson to address the policy memo they presented. Scott asked me in his absence, he's in Hawaii more or less for a month, and he wasn't able to be here. February meetings are difficult for Scott. Board Member Davies, where this started was, if you recall, the master project schedule about a year ago. There was a proposal on the table to add a scientist for East Side to help SAGE move projects forward. Instead of being associated with just a single project, the intent was to have multiple projects. What happened was, in the process of the budget discussion at CEMER and the policy, the position was left within the master project schedule, but it was unfunded for this biennium, with a placeholder in out years. But it wasn't approved to go ahead and add that new position. Instead, what was discussed was spending the money on the projects and adding scientists on project positions, including an East Side scientist. We had an NREP person that was associated with the project, but when the project didn't move forward, they moved on to another job. And so the thought was, if we had a dedicated Eastside scientist, then we'd have some continuity. And frankly, it just didn't make it into the budget during this current biennium. The discussion is no way over in terms of adding that position, but we don't have that. Now, on the west side, in contrast, at the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, we have a supervisor position, scientist position. We have a riparian ecologist position. We have a recently vacant, last month vacant, geologist position there. We have a vacant wetland scientist position at the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission. And then we have a CMER geomorphologist position that is filled.
So are those all five positions funded through?
Yes.
Okay. So I've heard from members of the East Side, and as the lone East Side person here on the board, I'd really like to see that position double. I don't know if we can find some money elsewhere, but
I share that interest.
Okay.
So thanks for bringing that up, and we certainly have a discussion about it.
In the discussion that policy is currently having around priorities and budgets and truing up the budget, I'll certainly bring that up, and many of them are in the room here that will be part of that discussion. So I'll make sure and tee that up for the next policy meeting to make sure that we do have a discussion, robust discussion around that.
Thank you.
Any other board requests for staff? So I just wanted...
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right, go ahead.
Well, this is not exactly a staff report thing. I didn't see that on the agenda, and you may not be prepared to talk to it, but I wonder if you have any news on cultural resources that you want.
Yeah, I was going to address it tomorrow.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fine. Okay. I can leave.
As a report from the chair.
Yeah, I have to cover that.
Yeah. Okay. So the only other comment before we move to our executive session is I know that we have not made a lot of progress on the carbon spotted owl issue in recent times. We have been doing a staff review on how to operationalize this and moving forward on a safe harbor agreement, and also looking at what mechanisms we have to have in place for authorities. We've got some of that information now, but we also have been policy light, if you will, because of many different priorities. So I'm working to resolve that so that we get this thing moving again. And I realize it is an important issue, but we are working to resolve that issue. So with that,
Chair Burnett,
yes.
If you or the board wanted to move the executive session to tomorrow, I see that tomorrow's agenda is scheduled to end at 2:40, and that we don't always color within the lines of our agenda, but depending on people's travel arrangements, I just wanted to make that option available to you in the board. I'll be here all week.
You'd like to, I'm hearing at least one board member wants to go ahead and have the executive session today. Is that all right with everybody else? That's fine.
That's a little time for
I think it's going to be 20 minutes or more.
Okay.
I'm hearing, let's go ahead and get it done. So with that, if we could clear the room for the executive session, So the purpose of the executive session is to inform the board of any anticipated pending litigation. It'll take about 10 minutes. And when we're done with the executive session, we're done with the meeting.